And welcome once again to EWTN's Bookmark. Our guest, author and old-time friend, Dale Alquist, the book, The Everlasting Man, a guide to G.K. Chesterton's masterpiece, published by our friends over at Word on Fire Press, naturally available through the EWTN religious catalog, EWTNRC.com for all things Catholic. Speaking of all things Catholic and all things Chesterton, there's Dale Alquist. Always great to have you here.
Doug, a great pleasure to be with you again.
So when was the first time you came to EWTN to espouse the greatness of Chesterton?
I was on Marcus Grodi's Coming Home show about 1999.
Okay.
And that's what led to the series then.
Right, yeah.
And the series, we filmed the first season in 2000.
Right.
It came out in 2001.
Right, absolutely. And that's right. You became big buddies with one of our big producers here, Steve Beaumont, who's a big acolyte of Chesterton and of your work.
Well, Steve is a great artist.
That's right. And he was one of the moving force behind a very popular show called James the Less.
Yes.
But this is really something about much more than that. This is Chesterton's book, but it's a guide, a commentary to his book. So his book is so good or needs so much explanation, you need a commentary. Which is it?
Well, it's funny because Evelyn Waugh, great English author, talked about how important this book was when it came out, and it says, and it needs no explanation. And that was pretty funny when he said that, because people have read this book, including me. This was the first Chesterton book that I read, and you know there's something there, but it's kind of a difficult path to follow, and it's mostly because this book was written in England 100 years ago, and we are in a different country, different culture, and just kind of it's amazing how different our heads are from that.
So let me ask you, in your students reading, and you talk about in the beginning about this idea of a description, and it turns out to be a horse, and you'll explain why you do that, why you put it at the front of the book. What would be the typical kind of reading of Chesterton which people would misunderstand today?
I think, with most of Chesterton, I think he is easy to read. There's just the great quotes that grab you and are self-explanatory. He's in many ways made for our culture with his sound bites, right?
Right, absolutely.
But when he develops a larger argument, he's got a lot of guns firing.
Okay.
And to try to put that all together, that's the big challenge, because truth is complicated. That's the whole point. The key to the lock has to be a complicated key to unlock a complicated lock.
Right, and you talk about it at the beginning and this description of a horse, and you say we're too familiar with a horse to see the strange creature they are. What was the point of that?
The point of that is that Christianity, people are too close to Christianity to really understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And so what the point of the horse is that he tries to get you back to see how strange a horse really is. You think you know what a horse is because you're familiar with it, but when you go back and his description of the horse doesn't sound like a horse until you listen to it. Oh yeah, he's describing a horse.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he tries to do the same thing with Christianity, is describe it in a way that you've never heard it before so that you can see it for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
People are too close to Christianity to understand it. They have to back way up and see the whole picture and see how it is the story.
See the forest through the trees.
Yeah, absolutely, see the story.
What is the problem with the people because they're too close? What are they missing, do you think, today?
They miss the significance of Jesus' unique role in history.
Compared to Buddha or the other, which he talks about, Confucius or whatever.
So we do the comparative religion thing, but we also show how the whole trajectory of history played out completely different when he stepped on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And that it wouldn't have happened unless he was who he said he was.
Right, and also you seem to indicate our history would be different if Carthage defeated Rome.
Yes, that's a really good point.
The Punic Wars.
Yes.
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. And one of Chesterton's great lines is that we should study the history that didn't happen, the history that might have been, because a few choices, a few differences, and the rest of the human story would have been very different.
You say, in reading Chesterton, I did not know that I was letting myself in for. So wrote C.S. Lewis in Surprised by Joy, the memoir of his conversion from atheism to Christianity. The Everlasting Man was the book that changed the direction of Lewis's life, he said. What was it, and did it change your life?
So, I'm going to answer both those questions, Doug. The first one, with C.S. Lewis, he was an atheist when he started reading the book. He liked Chesterton's writings in the essays that he'd read. Mm-hmm. He had several of his books he read. He liked everything about him except his Christianity. Mm-hmm. And then when he read The Everlasting Man, he said it was the first rational explanation of Christianity he'd ever heard. And you know, he'd later say that a young man who's serious about his atheism cannot be too careful about what he reads. Mm-hmm. So yeah, his life changes completely. With me, well, I was a Baptist, evangelical, big C.S. Lewis fan. Mm-hmm. And because I knew this book and Chesterton had such a big influence on C.S. Lewis, this was the first...
You wanted to kind of understand...
Yeah, I want to get behind C.S. Lewis, figure out what...
Now you quote and say that other people say this is his masterpiece, but from your perspective, there's too many masterpieces.
Yeah, that is my perspective, too many masterpieces.
to pick just one.
Yeah.
And you also point out that even with his critics, if they refuse to arrive at Chesterton's conclusions, they want to travel with him. And you go on to talk about the obvious cases being people like he knew, like H.G. Wells and George Bernard Shaw, which is interesting, some of these, and other lesser knowns like George Moore. But I know later on in his book, Heretics, they talked about him, that he considered them heretics.
Yeah, yeah.
But they were friends.
They were friends. He knew how to get along with his enemies because...
Unlike Belloc.
Yeah, Belloc was not so good at getting along with his enemies. He was more important with keeping the enemies than keeping the friends. But with Chesterton, he really did care about what the other person thought, but he also cared about them as humans. So he was charitable, and people were attracted to his charity and his goodness and his humor, but he was not afraid of attacking their bad arguments. But he never made it personal. He just says, you have a bad idea. I'll show you why it's a bad idea. And he was able to engage them. So they read his books. They journeyed along with him, as I said.
Just as Chesterton describes in this book how early Christianity went through a period when it was important enough to be ignored, quote unquote, before it was actually suppressed. So Chesterton is going through that period of being important enough to be ignored. That's your opinion of what's going on now?
Yeah, so Chesterton went through his own dark ages after his death. People stopped reading him, and he stopped being taught.
What was the?
I think the two main reasons they stopped reading was because he stopped writing. That was the main one.
Okay.
He was more than just an author of books. He was a newspaper columnist.
Right, right.
So they read him. They were used to reading him in the newspaper. But then World War II comes. It's a very dark period in history. Mm-hmm. Chesterton's style of joy and thankfulness just didn't quite fit to the times, right?
Right, and where was God in all of this?
And where was God in all this, exactly. And so it took a while for people to start listening to his message again. And so he gets rediscovered starting in the late 80s, early 90s, and then,
Thanks to people like you.
Well, and thanks to people like you. For the show on EWTN did a lot to spur the Chesterton revival. It did an awful lot.
Well, like you said, he's the soundbite king, he's made for memes, really. At the outset of his book, Chesterton says he is taking a historical approach rather than a theological one. Why did he make that point, and why did he take that approach?
Because salvation history is all of human history. Mm-hmm. And it's by telling the human story, you can see how salvation works. You can see how Jesus, the man, entering into history changes history. And the theological and philosophical strains are part of that story, mm-hmm. but he chose to make them, the secondary part, because it's the historical part that it leads the narrative.
You say we cannot understand Christianity unless we first understand paganism, and who cannot understand paganism cannot understand Christianity. And the book is broken up into two sections, right?
Same two sections that the Bible is broken up to, B.C. and A.D. So everything leading
it's
up
BCE
to Christ.
Not BCE any.
We're even before that.
Oh, okay.
So the idea is that studying pagan history shows that people are looking for God and how they're trying to seek God. And he says it's through a natural religion because there's no revelation.
So there's this natural sense you see throughout history,
right,
of people always knowing there's another,
right,
there's something greater,
right. And there's this one little tribe that is protecting the one true God, the God in the box in the tabernacle, who remain monotheistic when everyone else has many gods.
Right.
But then, then they have their collision. Mm-hmm. And it's the people who have been looking for the one true God find him, and the ones who've been carrying God with them see him face to face. It's this wonderful convergence.
And it shows a dramatic differentiation between those earlier kind of pagan deities, so to speak.
Yes.
And Jesus, who is the everlasting man. Right?
Yeah, he is the everlasting man. But there's also this interesting element that man is the everlasting man. Mm-hmm. It's you know, that's why there's a play on words in this title.
Okay, he says, in the everlasting man, he describes the man who is trying to find, maybe that's what you mean, find his home because he did not stay at home. That describes all of us. I don't even know what that means.
So the very first line in the book is, there's two ways of getting home. One of them is to stay there. Mm. And the irony of this book and my own story is that I read this book in Rome.
Mm. And yes, you used to talk about that in the book.
And I'm on my way to Rome. I have to go all the way around the world to get back to Rome, which turned out to be my home. I found the church because I found G.K. Chesterton. Mm. And so...
You were on your honeymoon, weren't you?
Well, yeah, that's what they say.
You're still married?
Yeah, to the original woman there. Yeah. So another evidence.
What
for
was Chester. She reading while you were reading Chester?
Oh, this is a good story. She was reading Les Misérables.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, right.
All right.
Mother Angelica had a lot of fun with that one when she asked me about that.
Oh, did she?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So this homecoming. We are looking for our home. You know, Odysseus is looking for his home. Odysseus is trying to get home. And, you know, our home is only going to be with God. So the pagans are trying to find their way home. And the Jews who were wandering in the desert were trying to find their way home, too. And, you know, the one who comes to a homeless place, Jesus is born, he's homeless where he's born. Mm-hmm. That all men are at home, Chesterton says, in this homeless place with the Nativity.
Right, and you talk about, because of his own personal situation, he had a great love for the Nativity, and for the child Jesus, similar to mother,
right.
But a great love for the child Jesus, El Divino Niño, obviously. It says, all the other things that Chesterton wrote, and he wrote about in these two books, and I guess the two was, what, The Everlasting Man and Orthodoxy,
right.
Which you referred to as could be considered bookends.
Yeah, the bookends.
Right. Now, Orthodoxy came first, right?
Yes.
Okay. So the idea of these, the artist's rendering of reality, a search for ultimate meaning, the sharp reality of evil, the romance of adventure, the adventure of romance. Well, he was big on going back and forth with words like mm-hmm. that. The struggle for daily bread. The festivity at the table, the dread of war, the cry for justice, the miracle of birth, pain of death, the riddle of suffering, and the deeper riddle of joy. So joy is a deeper riddle than suffering.
It is, and that's a great Chesterton paradox, mm-hmm. right? Suffering is the question we all ask about. Chesterton's favorite book of the Bible is Job. You know, why do we suffer? But the real mystery is, why is there joy?
Mm-hmm.
Why is there joy? It's because there's God, and learning to be joyful which is what Chesterton's secret is. He's mm-hmm. he really is this giant of joy. That's, I think, one of the reasons people are drawn to G.K. Chesterton is because of his great and deep joy.
Right. Yeah. So is your tongue now molded?
Is my tongue molded?
Yeah.
Sure, Doug.
It says, yet you had you were one of those unmolded tongues, weren't you?
Oh, yeah, he's
Father O'Connor, right?
That's right. That's right. What Father O'Connor says. Right. The Chesterton will have this effect on tongues yet unmolded. My tongue was then unmolded when he wrote that. It has been molded since, yes.
You say, just as creation reveals much about its author, this book will reveal much about its author as well. What does it reveal?
It reveals... you know, my own story with Chesterton has been a great journey. I have been able to affect a lot of lives, not only because of the television show on EWTN, but, you know, now starting the Chesterton Academies, there's just this huge ripple effect
mm-hmm.
because I have been able to bring Christ to other people through G.K. Chesterton. And they've been attracted to his interesting character, his humor,
right.
his gianthood, and his humility, and that has changed lives and changed souls.
Right, absolutely.
I've played this small role in doing
it. Right, and that was always Mother's goal for the network, too.
Yeah.
And we even continue today. It's not directly related to you, but if it wasn't for you, we wouldn't be doing Chesterton Station.
That's right.
Now, yep. as well, on the program. You talk about this is ultimately a work of love. With this book, G.K. Chesterton has fulfilled the two great commandments. How so?
Love God and love your neighbor, right?
Okay.
So obviously his great task is to love God. That's the first commandment. But you can't do the first commandment without the second. And Chesterton was excelled at loving not only his enemies but to love his neighbor because right. he says they're the same people, right? So he did do that in bringing the gospel to his neighbors. And this is such a unique telling of the gospel that's why it has struck so many people. I know lots of people who became Catholic because they read that book.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, you say that this book should really probably be dedicated, in a sense, because the reason you wrote it was because of H.G. Wells.
Yeah, so H.G. Wells, famous science fiction writer, also a famous agnostic and skeptic and immoral man, mm-hmm. Wrote a best-selling book called The Outline of History.
Right, okay.
And in that book, he treats humans as just another animal that's crawled out of the muck,
right.
And Jesus is just another man in history. And so Chesterton says he gets the two main things wrong in the book, the two mm-hmm. main things wrong. First, that humans are unique among creatures, and that Christ is unique among men.
The differentiation between ourselves and animals
right.
is lost there.
So the first two parts of the book are the creature called man mm-hmm. and the man called Christ.
Right. Now, I thought that was interesting too, and this I was thinking related to people today. He found Wells' utopias naive, giving elaborate accounts of man's overcoming small difficulties while assuming that all the great difficulties will have somehow been overcome already. Do you think that we have a lot of people today, especially young people, and I guess it's part of being young, this utopian idea of constantly comparing reality against utopianism, which of course reality will always fall short.
Well, you think about the whole Star Trek series, for mm-hmm. instance, Doug. If you recall, they've solved the problem with war on Earth and crime on Earth, and that's why they were able to start to explore the stars.
Right.
And they solved all the big problems. It's just all these little technical things are the new challenges. Yeah. Completely missing the point. Setting aside the major problem, they just wiped that aside.
You said, sir, what is ironic is that the man who placed so much faith in the solutions offered by scientific technology, that would be Wells, was so despairing of the future. No one would want to live in a Wellesian utopia. I certainly wouldn't want to be hanging out with the Morlocks.
Certainly, in
a time machine.
There's absolutely nothing in his science fiction that is appealing.
Right. I mean,
and so his own pessimism caught up with him in his creativity.
Right, and it also talks about how he would fight with Belloc, and in some ways Chesterton wrote his own rebuttal to Wells' book in this book.
That's what it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
In the introduction to Planet's book, when the world goes wrong, it proves rather that the church is right. How so?
Well, the church is here because of man's sin. Mm-hmm. That's why the church exists. And it's a great Chesterton paradox. He goes, it's the problems with the world that proves that the church is right, because we have the solutions that the world is looking for. So, and he says man's sinfulness mm-hmm. is actual evidence that the church is true in its message.
You say Chesterton intends for this book to be an apologetic about Christianity and not Catholicism per se. Why did he make that distinction?
So he talks about his conversion, just makes a brief reference to it as the chief event of his life, and he says, in a separate book, I'll write about that. Mm-hmm. He's trying to be as going, because he realizes that he's living in England. He knows that the Church of England is the larger church, and he wants to defend Christianity as a whole rather than the Catholic Church specifically in this particular book. What's interesting, that's his plan, mm-hmm. but when you get to the end, he says when Jesus came, he founded a church. He didn't
right.
start a religion. He says, with all the things that are in a church right now, and so it ends up being very much a Catholic apologetic.
There's a lot of stuff about horses in here. and you have it later, I think, out there, but the Chesterton's epic Ballad of the White Horse. Why is that important?
So the Ballad of the White Horse is based on a big chalk drawing mm-hmm. on the side of a hill in England mm-hmm. that was actually made by just clearing away the turf, revealing this white chalky gravel underneath. You can see it for miles, okay? Mm-hmm. But if you're close to it, you can't tell that it's a horse.
Okay, so it's that classic.
It's the same thing.
You need to step back.
Exactly.
To understand really what's been. He said, either Christianity is true or it isn't. And he goes, Chesterton makes the rather bold claim that as a believer, he can be fair to both sides, whereas the unbeliever cannot.
So the unbeliever does not know the inside of the church, doesn't know the inside of the story. But the one who has been outside and is now inside knows both sides. And that's why you can be fair to both sides. It's no matter how objective the unbeliever tries to be, he can never fully be sympathetic with what the believer knows.
Is that also why he goes through the whole pagan thing, so he can demonstrate his understanding as well and sympathies in some ways for what those people were going through?
And he does a great job of showing his sympathy with the pagan march.
Now, did Chesterton run into Plato in the cave, or is it a different cave?
There's a reference to Plato's cave, and right. I don't know if they read it. But you know, a lot of my students read this book. They talk about, you know, the man in the cave, and they say, "Well, is it Plato's cave?" And that's a great discussion that they have. Right. Is it Plato's cave?
Yeah, Chesterton says that it's good that innocence should be at the front and wisdom right behind it.
So that's a reference to Don Quixote.
Okay, right.
And the idea is
you got Sancho and Don Quixote and Mr. Pickwick and Sam Weller.
Yeah. You know, talks about, yeah. Right? So the innocence should lead the way, but knowledge should be backing it up. But if innocence is following knowledge can go askew without being innocent.
You also talk a little bit about here, Blessings in Disguise, the autobiography of Guinness and Guinness's conversion process.
Yes, now we're talking about Alec Guinness, the actor, not Guinness the beer, just to make sure that everyone understands that. But yeah, Alec Guinness played Father Brown in a movie. And
Obi-Wan Kenobi,
And absolutely, it was a great story of how by dressing up as a priest, he saw the respect people had for priests, especially children, and that made him look differently at the Catholic Church. And he was already a Chesterton fan, so yeah. G.K. Chesterton helped Obi-Wan Kenobi become Catholic.
Chesterton exposes the limits of physical science, which in spite of its great advances cannot measure the immeasurable or observe the observable. Based on fragments and often on missing fragments, the scientist describes the daily habits of creatures who are now no more than dust. It is one of the things, too, we've been dealt with this whole thing, the science is settled.
Yes.
Well, the most thing is, I mean, nobody would want a doctor from 150 years ago treating them with what they thought the settled science
was,
right?
Great point. Yeah, science is always changing its mind. Yes, yes.
Where faith isn't.
Faith isn't, right. Theology has a much more stable history than science.
Right. Agnosticism, says Chesterton, is the ancient confession of ignorance.
I love that definition. Because what is it? The word agnostic is the Greek word for the Latin word ignorant. Mm-hmm. So, you know, an agnostic is usually say, well, you know, I'm an agnostic. They say it proudly. But they don't say proudly, well, you know, I'm ignorant. But it's the same meaning. It means the one who doesn't know.
Right.
And, yeah, the ancient confession of ignorance.
Why does Chesterton call matriarchy moral anarchy?
So, he gives the example that With patriarchy, you have the father as the stable figure. With matriarchy, the father is a fugitive. Mm-hmm. And that's what leads to moral anarchy, when the father's not a stable figure in the family.
Are we seeing that in our society over the last 50 years, especially?
I think we've seen pretty good examples of that.
In a lot of places, What is the real difference in antiquity of civilization? What is the real difference between civilization and barbarism?
So, civilization and barbarism, civilization is ordered. It has an ordered way of passing the culture on to the next generation. It has laws, and it starts having elevated art and philosophy and thinking. And barbarism has none of those things and will also destroy those things. Barbarism is always attacking civilization.
And focused on the externals.
Basically it's appetite. It's living by appetite.
Chesterton starts with two solid and stupendous facts called Egypt and Babylon. One still represents the dawn of civilization, the other, ironically, represents the demise of civilization.
Yeah, so Babylon is, you know, we associate it with the end of civilization, everything coming apart.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And many times the church is attacked as being related to Babylon.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, elsewhere you say, by the end of this chapter, we arrive at the greatest of ancient civilization, one that's still with us today, Rome. But we get there by way of Troy. And that's where I just want to allude to in our last minute about mythology. And he talks about mythology and why that's actually important, a proper understanding of it.
Yeah, absolutely. So mythology is this poetic attempt to to get to the truth, to get to understand our Creator, to what's behind it. And it's man's attempts to do it. And he does not attack mythology. Actually, he honors, that's why we still teach mm-hmm. mythology, because these are stories, not that they did happen, mm-hmm. but that they always happen. They have a truth that they keep telling. That's why he says, you know, we study the Iliad because all of life is a battle. We study the Odyssey because all of life is a journey. So,
journey, right?
So that's why mythology is important. But then it has its fulfillment, again, in Christ. There has to be one myth that is true. The God who comes down from heaven for real.
We just got 30. Nature is looking for the supernatural, but it gets distracted by the unnatural.
Yeah, so the
open that up for me.
The great element there is that there are elements that people will use to get to effects, and that is witchcraft and evil and demons. That's where the supernatural becomes unnatural.
Okay, well, tell us, you have another book in the works?
Yeah, I've got one or two more. I'll be happy to talk to you about those sometime.
Okay, great. That's great. That's great to see you again, Dale.
That's a
great,
right.
Great work. Very interesting, of course. Dale Acquist with G.K. Chesterton. How can you miss out on that? The Everlasting Man, a Guide to G.K. Chesterton's Masterpiece, with wonderful insights from Dale. Word on Fire Press, available naturally through our EWTN Religious Catalog. EWTNRC.com for all things Catholic. Thanks for joining us right here on Bookmark, and we shall see you next time.